Hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's episode of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Danya Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices in the northeast of the United States.
And this is Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're going to be talking about the Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine publication, the February 2022 issue. And if you don't know what Critical Decisions is, what are you waiting for? Critical Decisions is ASAP's official CME publication. Each month, we talk about two lessons that cover the critical decisions that you need to think of when you're working.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, our newest feature, the clinical pediatrics, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
So let's start with our first lesson of the day. Once bitten, twice shy, mammalian bites. Thank you to Drs. Nandita Shivaprakash and Robert Vizzetti for writing this article.
Okay, so we're going to talk about dog and cat bites?
But also humans and bats.
Oh.
Because we are technically mammals. I know,
and
right?
Bats are mammals.
Yeah, they like breastfeed their babies or something. I don't know. They are not birds, I tell you that.
Okay.
So, yeah, and now there's like a fifth grader somewhere rolling their eyes at us going like, really, these people are doctors. But out of all of these mammals, dogs are the most common. They're often like unprovoked, and they're usually like on your extremities or face. Whereas with feline, it's often provoked. You piss a cat off, it bites you. And they can be pretty terrible because dogs can actually exert a lot of pressure. So they can actually cause like crush injuries and with like really young kids, even fractures. Whereas with cats, it's like a puncture wound that's actually way deeper than it looks. Now, humans, those are a problem. The most common ones are the ones that we know talk about a lot, which are the fight bites, when the hand is injured by the teeth of the person being punched, or like an occlusion bite. With that, what I remember is that people are usually not very forthcoming about it, so you usually have to have a very high index of suspicion. Now, bats are even trickier than humans because their bites and scratches may not be apparent, and therefore, like the victims may not seek medical advice. And that would suck because, you know, they carry rabies in all 50 states except for Hawaii.
Okay, interesting. So then what pathogens should we worry about with each of these bites?
So you always need to think of like, what is the oral flora? I mean, don't think about it too much. It's kind of gross, but you need to think of the oral flora. You need to think of the ingested prey and you need to think of the surrounding environments, like the water sources and stuff. Yeah, I know it's totally gross. So usually they're polymicrobial, and knowing the exact bacteria is an important board's question. In life, just broad spectrum everything. The other thing to also remember, other than the like things that are actually in the bite, is with cat scratch disease, that people can get sick, not from what's in the mouth, but because they carry things like Bartonella, tularemia, sporotrichosis.
Okay, got it. Location of the bite, what animal actually bit you, and what else do we need to know?
So timing is pretty important. Keep in mind that cats can cause rapid onset cellulitis within like less than a day. And some reports mentioned 3 hours for a bite to get infected, which is insane to me. That's like a very short wait time in an emergency department, which is like really scary. But other things that we need to think about as well are, one, injuries that are missed because we're distracted by that big bad bite. And the other one is retained foreign bodies, which may require like imaging with an x-ray and ultrasound if you have a high clinical suspicion. And then of course, just like any injury, especially to an extremity, you need to do a neurovascular exam. And you need to also understand the patient's immunization status, like their tetanus immunization, and if relevant, like their rabies immunization as well.
That makes sense. What are some complications we need to think about then?
So just like any infection, it can spread to nearby important things like osteomyelitis, tenosynovitis, tendinitis, deep infections of the hand, especially with things like fight bite. If we don't catch that and take care of it well, it can get pretty problematic.
So how do we deal with these bites and all the itises?
The first thing that we need to do is copious irrigation at home, when or wherever it is that this happens, and in the ED. And that actually may require pain meds in order for us to do that copious irrigation, especially in kids or if somebody has an extensive injury or a face wound. So I don't know what your practice is, Wendy, but for me, I do like a quick irrigation and then I numb the wound and then I continue doing that irrigation. So especially if I was doing like a block or something like that, because that would allow me a lot of like local control of that pain and be able to irrigate it really well. The article also talks a lot about how you should and can use intranasal things in kids or adults like fentanyl, Versed, and so on, but mostly an analgesic to help with the pain. After you do that irrigation, you need to debride the devitalized tissue and explore the wound to make sure there are no hidden foreign bodies. And then you need to understand what that animal or mammal's vaccination status is and their whereabouts, if that's an incident where you need to involve like local authorities, animal control, and so on.
That makes sense. And great tip about definitely good analgesia to allow you to evaluate the wound more extensively. Maybe these animals have vaccination apps.
I think that would happen way earlier than it would happen for humans, but that's a whole other story.
It's true. Okay, I have a big question for you. Do we close these wounds?
So that's a really interesting question. I don't know what you learned, Wendy, or how you practiced, but my understanding was that the answer is usually no unless it's a face wound. But this article seems to be rather liberal in ones that you can close. And some of the other restrictions they list there are like high risk of infection, such as like bites from cats, humans, monkeys, or livestock. So dogs apparently are not on that super high risk list. Two, if it's a heavily contaminated bite. And then with extremities, if it's longer than 12 hours, or with a face, if it's longer than 24 hours. Or immunocompromised patients. Otherwise, the article seems to be advocating, maybe is the correct word, to actually close it. And the other thing to remember is that tissue adhesive is a big, big no. You don't use that if you were to close your wounds.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I learned the same as you too in terms of generally we try not to close a wound, but very good to know. Now, who gets antibiotics then?
Any wound that you close needs antibiotics. Cat bites, deep puncture wounds, bites to the hand, genitals, or close to a joint. If the wound is moderate to severe, if there's any crush injury, or if there are bites in immunocompromised patients. So basically, the only ones you don't give antibiotics to sound like open, small dog bites in healthy people. Other than that, everybody else gets antibiotics. And for antibiotics, our antibiotic of choice is amoxicillin clavulanic acid, which is Augmentin, or if you're looking for something IV, then ampicillin sulbactam. However, if a patient has a true penicillin allergy, then trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole or Bactrim plus clindamycin are acceptable options. Now, with MRSA, you should consider that if the bite wound is like really severe, or if there already is a post-bite infection, or the patient is known to have MRSA. You should only give them 3 to 5 days of prophylaxis with a wound check in 24 to 48 hours. But if an infection has already developed, we're talking longer than that, like 7 to 14 days. And if there's like bone or joint involvement, then even longer, like weeks and weeks.
Okay, I have another question for you. Who do we need to worry about rabies in?
So domestic dogs don't really carry rabies anymore in the United States. And among domestic animals, cats actually account for most reported rabies cases. So I don't know how you're feeling about cats after this podcast, Wendy, but I mean, I never liked cats, and now I like them even less because they seem to pop up in all the questions where we need to do extra things because it's bad. You should also think about rodents and lagomorphs who can theoretically carry rabies, but that's pretty rare. Now, the question is, what do you give? Do you give the vaccine? Do you give the immunoglobulin? What do you do? And I find it always very confusing. It really depends on whether the patient has had the rabies prophylaxis series in the past or not, and if they're vaccinated or not. Now, if they haven't had any post-exposure prophylaxis before, you give them everything. you give them the vaccine, and then you give them the immunoglobulin on days 0, 3, 7, and 14, which is only 4 times. It used to be 5. And that immunoglobulin is infiltrated directly around the wound as much as possible. And then the remaining volume is intramuscularly in as far of a location as you can from the actual vaccine. Now, if this person has already had post-exposure prophylaxis, then you don't do immunoglobulin and you just do vaccines on days 0 and 3. And if the person has already had the vaccine before, then no vaccine. And it's something that I forget to ask people. Like, I only think of like, hey, has the animal been vaccinated? But no, humans are vaccinated too. Like veterinarians, certain lab workers, certain government jobs. So we got to definitely think about that.
Oh, interesting. I did not know about that. Then what about tetanus? Give them a booster if their last one was 5 years ago and the wound is dirty and complex?
So yes, if the wound is dirty and complex, you need to renew it after 5 years. If it's like simple, clean, it's just 10 years. But that's only if they've had the full vaccine series before, which is not everyone. Some adults were never vaccinated as kids, which is a story for another day. And the other one that can be pretty tricky is kids, because I don't know what their vaccine schedules are. So if the kids have not completed their 3-dose series, then those are kids that should be given immunoglobulin in addition to the vaccine if we're talking about dirty complex wounds. If we're talking about something super low risk, then no.
Thank you, Dania. I learned a lot about what are mammals, as well as the bites we have to worry about. Our listeners are probably laughing. Yeah, bats are mammals. Great.
I think we should watch the Discovery Channel or Animal Channel or some other channel.
Oh, I would like that. I want to watch some meerkats. Anyhow.
From afar, yeah. Where they cannot give you rabies.
Agreed. So I think remembering that the type of bites each of these mammals can create can be more complex than what you see on the skin. Some may be crush injuries, some may be actually puncture wounds. And a lot of the things we worry about these mammalian bites are, of course, you know, the flora of that mouth. Timing is super important, as you mentioned. Don't forget looking for foreign bodies. And really, it takes a good analgesia to irrigate the wound extensively to explore it too. You can consider closing the wound if they don't have any high risk for infections. And most wounds may need antibiotics, especially if you do close them. Review the article for how to approach rabies series as well as vaccination. And Hawaii is a good place to go.
For multiple reasons, but also because the bats there don't have rabies.
Well, hopefully when you're dealing with animal bite, you didn't end up also falling and sustaining an inferior shoulder dislocation.
Well, I mean, if you had read this issue, then you should be prepared for both, because our critical case in orthopedics and trauma is about inferior shoulder dislocation. So you should be fine, Wendy. Just read the issue. You can deal with both.
So this is a case of a person who fell and has right shoulder pain, deformity, and decreased range of motion with inability to adduct their right arm. And while we take care of a lot of patients who have shoulder dislocations in the ED, only 0.5% are inferior dislocations.
Well, that's not a lot at all, which is why we probably don't do a good job picking them up or fixing them. The classic presentation is a fixed abduction position where their arm is held above their head, where the elbow is flexed and the forearm is pronated. So like that. And you can basically... I'm so glad our listeners can see. And you can basically palpate the humeral head in the axilla. And these patients are at high risk of neurovascular injury because the dislocated humeral head disrupts the space where the brachial plexus and axillary artery are hanging out in the axilla.
That's right. There's not much space there for all of those things. On x-ray, you may find that the humeral head is parallel to the spine of the scapula. Compared to with anterior dislocations, you would find the humerus parallel to the chest wall. And in terms of reduction, you can try traction, countertraction, but that may be difficult. So another technique this section described is you can have the patient lay supine as the clinicians stand next to the patient's head. And you're essentially going to rotate or push the head of the humerus anteriorly, converting this inferior dislocation to an anterior dislocation. Then you can use any standard reduction technique.
So this actually reminds me of a case that I had a very long time ago where it was a kid. And just to make things even more complicated, right? But that was the thing, is that it looked, so it was a community hospital, I was reading my own x-rays, and it looked dislocated. And then I push it back and it popped back. But then I get the x-ray and it looked dislocated again because it went from inferior to anterior and then it popped back in. So,
wow.
That was my hint.
Awesome.
So for our critical procedure this month is something that's slightly more complex than trying to figure out the inferior shoulder dislocation, which is closed thoracic lavage rewarming, which is probably something that you don't want to be doing on a regular basis. However, it is still pretty cold outside and hypothermic arrests are happening. So you know what? You may require active rewarming. And thoracic lavage is actually faster than all the other less invasive rewarming techniques because it works with a large body surface area that is very vascularized, you know, the lungs. So if you warm those, then the person is warm. So if their temperature is less than 30 Celsius or they're having arrhythmias attributed to that hypothermia, then you probably should just actually put hot water, not boiling water, but warm saline in their chest. So basically you can warm a 1 liter normal saline bag in the microwave for 60 seconds and then agitate it. So just shake it to distribute the heat and then 60 more seconds and then agitate it again. And then in the chest.
Yes. You can put it into the chest using one or two chest tubes or even just with a thoracostomy in an open technique. The article describes using two chest tubes. Essentially, you want to put one between the second and fourth intercostal space in the midclavicular line to instill the warm fluids, and then place the second chest tube at the fifth or sixth intercostal space in the mid-posterior axillary line, you know, posteriorly, to drain the fluid. And when you're done with this lavage, you can essentially remove the anterior superior chest tube and leave the one, you know, posteriorly, to continue to drain. There isn't enough evidence, though, to guide you on whether you should perform this unilaterally, bilaterally, or which side is better.
I would go with whatever you can do to warm this person up. Sounds fantastic.
Agreed.
So for our critical EKG this month, it's a reminder that regularly irregular QRS complexes can either be a second degree AV block or PACs. So PACs usually have a different P wave morphology because they come from an ectopic atrial focus. There's a short compensatory pause and then the normal beats resume. So that would be your hint in figuring out that that's a PAC rather than a second degree AV block.
The critical EKG this month also has other pearls, such as the differential diagnosis of wide QRS complexes. So definitely check that out.
And moving on to the LLSA review, we're talking about the Established Status Epilepticus Treatment Trial, or the ESSET trial, which basically we're reviewing Kapoor et al.'s 2019 study in New England Journal, randomized trial of three anticonvulsant medications for status epilepticus. So Wendy, I know you cannot contain your excitement because we're talking about neuro and the LLSA review. So take us away.
I swear I don't plant these.
You do. I know all about it.
Right. This particular trial was a randomized controlled trial that compared fosphenytoin, levetiracetam, and valproate for benzo-refractory status epilepticus. So essentially any patient who's gotten, you know, appropriately dosed benzos and are still seizing. And they looked at determination of clinical seizures with improved mental status within 60 minutes. And I think it's definitely changed our practice since this trial was published because they found that there was similar efficacy among all three of these anti-epileptics, around 45% or so. And so I think this is definitely the evidence we needed to really use any of these three agents for people who still need control of their seizures despite benzos. There are a few other takeaways, though, other than just the fact that these medications were pretty equivalent in their efficacy. The dosage of these medications were kind of new-ish to the field, in that we've always known to dose fosphenytoin as 20 milligrams per kilogram, but the dosage of levetiracetam in the study was 60 milligrams per kilogram with a max of 4,500 milligrams, and then the dose of valproate was 40 milligrams per kilogram with a max of 3,000 milligrams. So some of these dosages may not have been as commonly used prior to this study. And then some other things that were also interesting, of course, are that we still continue to find that we often underdose benzodiazepines in people with status. And so,
definitely great reminders that benzos are the number one. We need to do a better job, but also whatever we give people, we should just do it correctly with the correct dose. So keeping up with our neuro theme, I will talk about this one, Wendy, which is our critical image for this month. And it's a great reminder that idiopathic intracranial hypertension, or IIH, cannot be completely excluded by imaging, but there are some things and hints on the MRI that can help, like empty cell sign, posterior globe flattening, optic nerve tortuosity, transverse sinus stenosis, and so on. But just because we have seemingly normal imaging does not mean that we are done. We still need to perform that LP to determine the intracranial pressure to either diagnose or rule out that IIH.
Great tips and great images to check out.
So moving on to our smaller sized patients, we're talking about clinical pediatrics, which is about bilious emesis due to malrotation with midgut volvulus, which contains way too many words that make me unhappy. So we did talk already about vomiting in kids last month, and we talked about the red flags to watch out for, and this is pretty much the reason we have red flags, is to catch this diagnosis. This is a 5-day-old who's presenting with bilious vomiting and found to be really dry, sunken fontanelle, decreased tone, but also distended abdomen and pretty fussy when you touch their belly. And they were diagnosed with malrotation with midgut volvulus, which is not a good diagnosis.
No, agreed. We had talked about that, you know, bilious emesis is a surgical condition, like an obstruction until proven otherwise. And so really, especially in a child that's less than a year old, we would be worried about things like duodenal atresia, Hirschsprung, meconium ileus, or malrotation with volvulus. Now, duodenal atresia is not classically associated with abdominal distension, whereas distal small bowel atresia could, and on x-ray, maybe you'll see something like a double bubble sign. If you're dealing with meconium ileus, it's usually seen in infants who have cystic fibrosis. To kind of help you figure out what is what, some of the diagnostics that may be needed are water-soluble enemas or abdominal ultrasound. For a patient who has a malrotation, like this child, depending on the acuity that they're presenting with, abdominal distension is usually a late finding.
So the diagnosis of volvulus may be confirmed by the x-ray, the upper GI and small bowel follow-through. But if the diagnosis is delayed, then at that point, the bowel ischemia will happen, we'll have necrosis, there'll be resection, prolonged TPNU, short bowel syndrome, nutritional deficiencies, basically all sorts of really horrible and sad things if this diagnosis is delayed. So definitely think of it in your child who is 1 or less years old and is coming in with that bilious vomiting. So keeping up with the pediatric theme, our second lesson of this month is Seek and You Shall Find, Pediatric Toxic Ingestions. Thank you to doctors Vandana Thapar, Cynthia Arantis, and Latonya Miller for writing this article. You know, Wendy, I love mystery shows.
You do?
I do.
So we can watch Animal Kingdom and Mysteries?
Yeah, and who's going to do all the work, Wendy? But yes, we should do that. However, mystery shows are so much easier than trying to figure out, like, the potential toxic ingestion that the kid took, because they don't tell you. Like, at least with mystery shows, like, the director eventually tells you who killed the person or kidnapped them or something.
True.
The kids don't.
Agreed. They don't come with a script. Come on now.
There are no subtitles. I need subtitles. So how are we supposed to approach these suspected ingestions?
These are definitely tough. And one thing is, who should we have a higher suspicion for? And it's important to remember that both unintentional and intentional ingestions have this bimodal distribution in the young, you know, less than 5 years old, because these are toddlers who are exploring and get into things. And then, of course, adolescents, they may be other concerns with intentional ingestions. So we do need to consider potential toxic ingestions in undifferentiated ultramental status, especially if those who have a prior history of ingestions. Our general approach to these patients are the same as any other critically ill patient. You address the ABCs. You do have to also think about, you know, safety of yourself and your staff. So whether you need to, you know, wear PPE and decontaminate the patient, and really try and get history from as many sources as you can, because you want to try and figure out, you know, what they were surrounded by, if there were any substances that were identified, what route that this may have occurred, whether it's ingestion, inhalation, or others, the dosage they may have taken, and timing. Timing is definitely key, because that plays a role into how you may treat these patients.
Those are all great tips. But what if you still can't figure out what the ingestion was? What are you supposed to do?
You're going to be a detective and collect more clues, such as from the patient's vital signs, you know, classic presentations if they're tachycardic, hypertensive, and febrile, their neurological exam, looking at their pupils, if they're really pinpoint or really dilated, their mucous membranes, if they're really dry, if their skin is super hot, and even their urinary output, to see if they are making urine, number one, or if they have things like urinary retention. All of this really trying to identify if there's actual toxidrome, you know, pattern to these clues. Oftentimes, we end up having to obtain a lot of different diagnostic studies, so a lot of labs, definitely starting out with your finger stick. And then other things like a CMP to look at your renal function and liver function, ABG and UA to look at, you know, not only your serum pH, but also your urine pH, your standard tox type of workup like Tylenol and salicylate levels, alcohol level, tox screen, even things like osmolality to figure out if you're dealing with a toxic alcohol, drug levels if you have a particular suspicion. And don't forget your EKG. That can be super helpful too.
All right. Basically, you're saying we have to actually do a physical exam and do drug levels and stuff. Any particular toxidromes that are more important in kids?
Obviously, anything kids get into can be quite dangerous, but we often learn about the whole concept of one pill can kill because they don't need much in their system to have a toxic effect. And lots of medications fall in this category, including antidepressants and, of course, cardiovascular medications. Specifically, you know, with antidepressants, like cyclic antidepressants, these patients can decompensate really quickly, you know, even within the first 2 hours after their ingestion. And that's because these cyclic antidepressants have many, many mechanisms. The sodium channel blockade effects can cause QRS and QT prolongation, hypotension and seizures. The norepinephrine reuptake inhibition can cause tachycardia and hypertension. And so these patients, you would have to use bicarb to treat for their cardiovascular toxicity. And you may even need to consider things like IV lidocaine, intralipid therapy, or even ECMO for cardiovascular support if they're in full failure. If you're dealing with, let's say, beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, remember that beta blockers, aside from its cardiovascular effects, it can also cause bronchoconstriction and hypoglycemia. And so treatment may include glucagon, but you may also need to give, you know, whether atropine if that works, or epi or dopamine to provide the inotropic and vasopressor support. Remember that hemodialysis is not useful for removal of these medications. And then calcium channel blockers can obviously also cause cardiovascular collapse. But the differentiating factor between a calcium channel blocker overdose, as compared to beta blockers, remember, is that calcium channel blocker overdose can present with hyperglycemia because there's decreased insulin release. And so these patients, again, may need atropine, pressors, pacing, or even ECMO, but would also need high-dose insulin for treatment too. And remember, this is high dose when you're dealing with 1 unit per kilogram as a bolus and 0.5 unit per kilogram as an infusion. So lots of toxidromes. It's always good to refresh, you know, our memories on each of these toxidromes. And the article has a fantastic table, not only listing these common toxidromes, you know, the medications that are associated with, as well as the actual treatments and antidotes.
Wow, that was quite an extensive review of the toxidromes. Definitely worth reviewing because thankfully it can be quite far in between when we see those patients. So let's just kind of take a step back and talk generally about ingestions. When should we give patients activated charcoal?
That's a good question because that comes up often. If they're presenting early enough, you know, within the first 2 hours of their ingestion, but more importantly, if they have, of course, a stable mental status and airway, because if they were to aspirate charcoal, that would be really, really bad. And then the other factor is whether that toxin can be actually bound by the charcoal. So typically, if it's a large, you know, molecule that's organic and has poor water solubility, then those are good candidates. It's also important to know some medications actually go through enterohepatic reabsorption. So these patients may actually need multi-dose charcoal. And this is with medications like carbamazepine, theophylline, phenobarbital, dapsone, and quinine. So not everybody, but some.
Got it. Any other tips?
Well, good thing we can always phone a friend, like our local poison control. And so, you know, hopefully that number is everywhere. 1-800-222-1222. And the sticker of Mr. Yuck.
I know, but like the sticker looks like it's a real sticker. And it doesn't make you think that these are things that you shouldn't be drinking as a child. I mean, I don't know.
True. Exactly.
That's just probably me.
I think the face kind of looks like a lot of cartoons nowadays.
I know, right? So they are really nice. Please call your poison control. They are not Mr. Yuck. They are awesome people. Call them. So thank you, Wendy, for taking us through this article. And it's definitely an important reminder of an important topic that can be quite scary. Always consider toxic ingestions and the undifferentiated altered mental status in a child that's less than 5 or any high-risk kid. Do a good physical exam because things like the pupils, the mental status, the mucous membranes in the skin, and so on are going to give you some tips for the toxidrome. Take a moment to go through the table in the article about what toxidromes look like, things like sodium channel blockers with tricyclics, beta blocker toxicities, calcium channel toxicities. Those are things that kill people very quickly. So we need to be able to pick up on that and treat them empirically with things that, when we were residents, that was not really much of a thing. The high-dose insulin, so on and so forth, intralipids. Like, but that's, you know, now an X number of years later. That's a lot more of a common thing. And remember, activate charcoal for anyone who's less than 2 hours after an ingestion with a stable mental status. And call your friends.
Yes. Yes. They'll tell you a lot more information and guide you through the process. For our drug box this month, it is on fluvoxamine, which is an SSRI that can also be used in COVID-19 as an outpatient. You know, the medication fluvoxamine is originally approved for treatment of OCD and depression, but it's been found to reduce inflammatory cytokines in mouse sepsis models and in vitro human studies. So it's been studied in 3 trials in non-hospitalized COVID patients, and they found kind of equivocal results. It's not currently endorsed by the Infectious Disease Society of America, IDSA. And there's lots of potential interactions because of its metabolism by cytochrome P450. It can cause serotonin syndrome and enhance antiplatelet and anticoagulation effects. So you may come across people asking or considering this medication. But again, right now, I think the evidence is not particularly strong for its use.
Got it. And then finally, last but not least, our talks box this month is pediatric cannabis ingestions. So basically, kids eating edibles. While edible formulations of cannabis are often infused with a lot of THC, like up to 500 milligrams in a package. So if you think about it, in adults, more than 25 milligrams can actually cause some like alteration to cognitive and psychomotor performance. So imagine what that would do to a kid. Even up to five milligrams, which is like tiny, causes pediatric intoxication. So more than that, you would get your sedation, nystagmus, ataxia, seizures, tachycardia, nausea and vomiting, respiratory depression, and sometimes lactic acidosis. Thankfully, these things don't last longer than 24 hours. Sometimes it may be even as little as six. So hopefully kind of like passes through. Supportive treatment is really what we need to do. And people need to start talking about edible safety, how to store them safely, since marijuana is decriminalized in a lot of states.
Very good point.
And actually just legal. So thank you, Wendy, for taking the time to go through this issue with me. I have learned a lot. Our dear listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this.
We hope that you find the Critical Decisions publication in our podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
We would love to hear from you on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Dania Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC. So shoot us some suggestions for good Animal Kingdom videos and mysteries.
I would love that. But also about the science too, if you want. Right. And until next month.
Bye-bye.